This is a podcast from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research institute that explores budget policies and issues affecting low and moderate income Americans.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. As you know, last week, House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan and Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon unveiled a proposal to convert Medicare to a premium support system. This proposal has attracted a great deal of attention, and while today's particular headlines may focus on the fate of the payroll tax bill in Congress, issues related to Medicare and proposals to convert it to premium support will be getting a lot of attention long after the current payroll tax debate is history. Here with us today to examine the Ryan Wyden plan are two leading healthcare experts. We're going to hear first from Ezekiel Emanuel, a world-renowned bioethicist and healthcare expert who's the former special advisor for health policy to the director of the Office of Management and Budget. Zeke is now chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy and also vice provost for global initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. We're also going to hear from Paul Vandewater. Paul is a senior fellow here at the Center on Budget, former assistant director of the Congressional Budget Office, assistant deputy commissioner for policy at the Social Security Administration, and former vice president for health policy at the National Academy of Social Insurance. Paul and Zeke have both written in the last few days about the Ryan Wyden plan. Paul's paper issued last Friday is on the center's website. And he also has a longer paper looking at issues in premium support in general that went up on September 26th. Zeke has a column out last night on the New York Times online on the Ryan Wyden plan. We're going to go to Zeke, then to Paul, and then directly to your questions. Zeke Emanuel.
Hi. Nice to be here with you. And let me begin with two disclaimers. The first is, as many of you know, I am actually and have been and remain a big advocate of universal voucher healthcare proposal. I think it actually is the best plan for the United States, so that gives me some credence in sort of being somewhat critical of these premium support plans when restricted to Medicare, which I think is a very different kettle of fish and not exactly right. The second point I would make is that, you know, I do have a great deal of respect for Senator Wyden, and I think he probably is the Senate one of the leading experts on healthcare and the healthcare system in the Senate and all of Capitol Hill. And so I think he's got very good thoughts on this. And so I say these things with some trepidation. I want to make three quick points, and we can get into, there are many points to be had about this. The first point I would make is related to the uniquely Washington wonkish world of scoring and saving money on the budget. And I think this is a very important point, which is that the anytime you have a growth, so the plan has these premium supports, and the real point, the real devil about its potential savings is how fast do those grow and how fast do those grow relative to the growth in healthcare costs. And the real issue here is that the growth of these premium supports pegged at GDP plus 1% doesn't save anything from a CBO scoring standpoint. And the reason is because we have in the Affordable Care Act the IPAB that is supposed to save at GDP plus 1%. So that's already going to be built in. So if you raise these things at GDP, if you raise the premium supports at GDP plus 1, you're not going to have additional savings above and beyond what IPAB does. And so from a budget standpoint, this is not a score. This doesn't score as a savings. So from saving the federal budget deficit, this doesn't have a big advantage. On the other hand, if you do what Paul Ryan did in his original proposal, which is, no, we're going to be down below GDP plus one, we're going to be at GDP or at healthcare or at underlying economic inflation, then you have the problem of, yes, you can save then, but that savings must occur because you're shifting costs to someone else. Now, you know, the classic in Ryan's original plan that someone else were seniors. Now we have a revised version, which, as I understand it, although it's still somewhat vague, is you're shifting the cost savings to providers in the Wyden Ryan plan, or to high cost or rich Medicare recipients. Well, you know, we've been in the provider cuts game before. We are in it in the SGR world. You know, sometimes we actually do make those cuts, and sometimes we don't make those cuts, as in the SGR world. So I do think that, in general, this situation is more of a cost shift than a cost saving. So this gets to my second point, which is, you know, the real challenge for the American society is healthcare costs in terms of national health expenditures. This premium support plan doesn't really do a whole lot for national healthcare expenditures at all. And part of the reason it doesn't do that, in my opinion, is that it doesn't address the underlying cost drivers of the system. Yes, it puts pressure on the insurance companies, but let me make two points about that. The first is, you know, over the last decade, maybe even two decades, the insurance companies haven't been terrific at controlling costs. You know, ask any businessman or CEO how well has their insurance company done at controlling their healthcare expenditures, and I don't think you're going to get a resounding endorsement. So the notion that the private sector is better here, which is a very typical ideological trope, I don't think can hold up in this circumstance. And the main reason is the following. If you really want cost savings, you have to get doctors and hospitals to practice differently. That's the real fundamental issue in our system. They have to practice in a different way. And to get them to practice in a different way, we need to pay them in a different way. And one of the frustrations that private insurance companies have is they don't have market power to force that. And that's why they have not really been able to get costs under control, because they can, you know, do something at the margin in terms of utilization, but they fundamentally can't transform the practice of medicine. And the main problem there is just market power. They don't have enough of the market to persuade doctors or hospitals to do something differently. Only Medicare, with, you know, roughly a third of the market, or, if you will, if for adult medicine and in lots of subspecialties like my own oncology, where they pay about 50% of the billings of most oncology practices go to Medicare. There, they have market power. They can drive the transformation. That Medicare hasn't done a great job about driving transformation, I think, is a whole other discussion. But that's why I don't think just shifting to the private sector without some market power there is going to drive reduced costs in the national healthcare, overall healthcare costs. The final point I would make is this point about risk adjustment. Now, as you know, away from Paul Ryan's original plan, which was basically let's kill Medicare as we know it, we've now got a whole series of plans, which is, look, we should have these private sector premium-supported arrangements, and one option that seniors would have is they could select traditional Medicare. Sounds good. You know, you're not forcing them one way or another, but then you get into this problem of how are seniors going to select? And how are you going to balance to make sure that the current or the competing insurance companies don't siphon off the healthy, get more money, and that traditional Medicare gets the sick? And the traditional answer is risk adjustment, which is the right answer, except for the following problem, which is that we're not the only country that does risk adjustment. You know, the Netherlands do, Israel does, other countries do it. No one's got it perfect. Almost all the risk adjusters end up still giving people who get healthy people an advantage. We know this in our own system, that the Medicare risk adjuster that they use is biases to the healthy, because in Medicare Advantage in Part C, those plans still go after healthy people and still get make a lot of money that way, and we know that they've been overpaid a lot, so that we know the Medicare risk adjuster, if that's the one you end up using, is not so hotsy-totsy and wouldn't say this. So if you play out the game, we have not a great risk adjuster, what is the likely scenario? The likely scenario is that the private plans with premium support siphon off healthy people, and they do it in the ways that they know how to do, which is, you know, you add certain benefits, you cut back on the benefits, you know, unhealthy people are likely to use, or you restrict the networks that you have of physicians or hospitals so that people who really are need attention don't go there. They end up in traditional Medicare. And so over time, and it's not going to be too many years, you're going to end up with healthy people mainly in the premium supported program, and then traditional Medicare is going to have much sicker patients and going to look like a terribly inefficient program. And then you're going to have calls for, wow, look at how bad they have all these high costs for patients. They can't run the system well. We're going to have to take it down. And really, it's just because of this very technical but very important element of risk adjustment. Now, you know, a lot of these problems get solved with a universal voucher system. You don't have elderly, you know, everyone's in the same pool with the same arrangement. But I think in it, where you just carve it out for Medicare, it creates a lot of serious problems. As I've mentioned, you know, no real budgetary savings. So the main rationale to reduce the federal deficit doesn't exist. No tremendous cost savings from the standpoint of national health expenditures, and then internal to the running of it, you have this problem that you are really going to segment the market in a very bad death spiral for traditional Medicare, despite all the rhetoric that, oh, no, we keep traditional Medicare for the first thing. So I want to thank you with that, and I will mute myself while Paul talks so I don't disrupt him.
Thanks, Zeke. We go now to Paul Vanderwater.
Thanks, Bob. I would, in my brief remarks, I'd like to focus just on one particular topic, to get into a little bit more depth on one of the topics that Zeke discussed, and that topic is the issue of the limit on the growth of Medicare spending that would be imposed by the Ryan-Wyden plan, and what would happen under that proposal if spending threatened to exceed the specified growth level. First thing to point out is that this plan is not entirely clear. The document that Wyden and Ryan have circulated is somewhat vague in points and even somewhat inconsistent. So what I will be discussing is our best interpretation of what the document means. The proposal specifies that under the Ryan-Wyden plan, the rate of growth of Medicare spending per beneficiary under the new premium support program would be limited to the rate of growth of gross domestic product, GDP, per capita, plus one percentage point. As Zeke explained, that target, that limit, is exactly the same target that the Independent Payment Advisory Board, the IPAB, is supposed to achieve under the current Medicare law. The Ryan-Wyden plan, however, does not explicitly spell out, as I indicated earlier, what would happen if growth in Medicare spending in a new program would otherwise exceed this target. Now, clearly, if all else fails, some automatic mechanism must kick in to cut spending growth, because without such a mechanism, the Wyden-Ryan proposal could actually increase costs relative to current law, since Zeke and I have now both said the IPAB is already directed to produce proposals to hold Medicare spending growth to that level. Now, the most likely automatic mechanism to cut spending under the Ryan-Wyden plan is a reduction in premium support payments on behalf of beneficiaries. Chairman Ryan appeared to acknowledge that in a December 15th briefing on the plan. That's the same approach used by other premium support proposals, such as that by Alice Rivlin and former Senator Pete Domenici, after which the Ryan-Wyden plan is modeled. And in an interview with the American Enterprise blog, Congressman Ryan also said that the Ryan-Wyden proposal would stop the open-ended defined benefit nature of the current system. So that's how we interpret the proposal. Now, to be sure, the Ryan-Wyden plan would give Congress a period of time in which it could intervene and act before the premium support payments were automatically cut. The proposal states, to offset, and I'm quoting, to offset an increase in the cost of Medicare beyond the growth limit, Congress would be required to intervene and could implement policies that change provider reimbursements, program overhead, and means-tested premiums, end quote. Now, of course, in fact, as a recent experience with the super committee has shown, Congress cannot, in fact, be required to intervene. Various fast-track procedures can be set up, but those might or might not lead to any results. So at the end of the day, there has to be some sort of automatic fail-safe mechanism, as I noted earlier. Now, despite this language in the report and this experience with previous fail-safe mechanisms, Ryan and Wyden may have something else in mind. Their proposal also includes a sentence saying that any increase over the cap will be reflected in reduced support for the sectors most responsible for cost growth, including providers, drug companies, and means-tested premiums, end quote. Now, that sentence appears to be referring, we think, to the steps that I just noted that Congress could take on a discretionary basis to avoid the automatic cuts. However, it could also be referring to some sort of an alternative automatic fallback mechanism. But Ryan and Wyden have not specified what that fallback mechanism might be, and it's very difficult for us to see how such an automatic mechanism might be made to work. Moreover, no other premium support plan has that kind of an automatic fallback. Now, in conclusion, Wyden and Ryan could readily resolve this ambiguity, along with others in their proposal, by providing legislative language. But unfortunately, they have said they don't intend to do that. In the absence of further specifics, we can only conclude that the Ryan-Wyden plan, like other premium support proposals, is indeed likely to shift substantial costs to Medicare beneficiaries.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining us today. The call is now concluded.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Read commentary from our experts at offthechartsblog.org. Find us on Twitter and Facebook, and create a My Center account at centeronbudget.org.